All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Brett Scharfs. I'm director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies. And my colleague, Gary Doxey, is scheduled to chair this session, but is not feeling well today. So he's not here, and I'm filling in. So my apologies for your hearing my voice once again, but I promise it will be very little. I'm just going to introduce our three speakers and then turn the time to them. They're listed in the program opposite the order they were told they were going to speak. So we'll follow what they were told rather than what's written in the program, which means we'll hear first from Stanley Carlson Tees, then Melissa Rogers, and then Alexander Dushku. The bios of all of our speakers are in the program, and so I won't belabor the introductions here. But I'll just say a brief word about each of our speakers. Stanley Carlson Tees is really a remarkable advocate for institutional religious freedom, and is also a great networker. He organizes a monthly roundtable in the Washington, D.C. area of many groups that are interested in freedom of religion, and is someone who is really well known and well respected and beloved for his interest in gathering people together to share ideas, to network, and to think through difficult issues together. Melissa Rogers, many of you have heard from already. She has been speaking at two of our breakout sessions today. Melissa, I apologize for working you as hard as we have today. I imagine we'll pay you double. The joke, of course, is she's here without being paid at all. So this is not a very large offer on my part. Melissa must be much older than she looks, because there's no way that she could have accomplished the things that she has done without that being the case. She's now a non-resident scholar at the Brookings Institution and also has an affiliation with Georgetown University. And until the end of the Obama presidency, was the head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, which was a new office, or a reconstituted office, in the Obama administration, really designed to reach out to religious groups and non-religious groups that are engaged on the grassroots level in trying to improve their communities. And she's someone who has been a problem solver and a consensus builder. The brochures that we have given you, the brochures on religion in the public schools, religion in the public square, religion in employment, really are the brainchild of Melissa. She started these more than 10 years ago and drafted the first set of these and then helped build the consensus around them that resulted in their development and publication through the Newseum Institute. And we're really pleased to be launching here at this conference the beta versions of the next generation of those pamphlets. And our hope is that through the Newseum and their network, we can find a similar broad coalition of people who are willing to sign on and lend their institutional credibility to these being fair-minded and balanced descriptions of pragmatic approaches to solving problems, and also to understanding what people's rights are, what the law is, and how religious differences can be accommodated in ways that are respectful without resulting in violations of the Establishment Clause. Prior to her work in the White House, she was the director of the Center for Religion and Public Affairs at Wake Forest University Divinity School, and also the director before that of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life and the general counsel of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. What you may not know about the Baptist Joint Committee is it's one of the leading religious freedom advocacy groups in the United States, and one of the oldest as well. With work perhaps not under that title, but going back to the founding era. So it is a really remarkable institution dedicated to religious freedom in the United States. Our third speaker will be Alexander Dushku. Alexander, I would like to claim, because he's a graduate of BYU Law School, but he graduated before I got here, and so I wasn't able to inflict my usual harm on him that I do on our more recent vintage students. Alexander also must be much older than he looks, because by appearances he should be a recent graduate, but it's really no exaggeration to say that Alexander is one of the leading practicing lawyers in the area of religious freedom in the United States. He's a shareholder at Curtin and McConkie, and works largely in appellate advocacy, which means not arguing cases before trial courts, but before courts of appeals, state supreme courts, federal courts of appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court. And he has been involved in writing briefs on virtually every important religious freedom case over the last 20 years. And so he's someone who has a practitioner's connection to the real world, something I happily lack, but also a scholar's acumen, which is something that appellate lawyers need as well, because appellate advocacy really straddles the bridge between advocacy and scholarship. There is a very strong scholarly component to good appellate advocacy. So without further ado, I'm just going to turn the microphone over, and we will start with Stanley. And then if there's any time at the end, we might have a few minutes for question and answers. But we're going to let all three presenters make their presentations before we open the floor. Stanley.
So those were kind words of introduction for all of us, and I appreciate that. I'm a coffee-drinking Calvinist, so I can be part of your diversity quotient. So I'm really honored to be on this panel and to speak to this conference, so thank you for the invitation. And I want to talk about religion and sex, or more precisely about how it might be possible to protect at the same time both religious freedom and other civil rights. And it's kind of odd to those of us working in religious freedom that so much of our work these days is about sex, but that's the way the world has turned out, so that's what we have to do. You know, this question of religious freedom and other civil rights involves constitutional principles and legal details, interpretive trends, court precedents, but I'm going to step back from all of that and consider broad trends and strategies, ideas, ways to think about these things and not the details of the law. So instead of a civil rights or non-discrimination approach, which is what we often think about for this, I want to recommend a government policy of pluralism that protects organizations of diverse convictions and practices. So thinking about reconciling religious freedom or religion and other civil rights, these days, it often means disputes about religion and sex, you know, about contraceptives, abortion, sexual orientation, gay marriage, gender identity. I want to remind you, sometimes it's actually still about religion. The Trinity Lutheran case, I think Melissa will talk about. But can a religious organization only hire people of the same faith? Is it possible, is it right for a faith-inspired organization to get government money and so on? So those issues are still there as well. There always will be tension, I think, between these different rights, but I think one reason why these conflicts seem so intractable is because we often see only kind of an either-or way ahead. Either one side wins or the other one, gay rights, religious freedom, religion is going to dominate everyone or else be put into a box in the corner. But I think a government policy of pluralism, what we already do to a large extent, may show us a better way to deal with these conflicts. So I want to make four points or arguments and then end with two public policy examples. All right, so four and then two. The four points. First of all, civil rights or non-discrimination model is not the only way to deal with these things, and it may not be the best way forward. Point two, conflicts between religious freedom and these other civil rights are often not disputes about religion and sexual equality, but rather disputes between different worldviews or moral systems. And then third, The religious freedom or religious exercise that needs to be protected is not only individual, but also institutional. And fourth, a public policy that protects the freedom of organizations to be distinctive, to embody distinctive religious and other visions and values, that kind of pluralist government policy is the way to make it possible for us to live together despite our deep differences. So that's my argument, and I'll use those two examples at the end. So first of all, the civil rights or anti-discrimination model is not the only strategy and may not be the best way forward. When we think about civil rights movement and the fight against segregation, we see this rightly as kind of an either-or thing. Either we are going to allow bigotry to be expressed against African Americans, or we're going to stop it. So we decided to stop it and to outlaw it. Is that what should be done in these other areas of dispute? If a person or organization, for example, treats a person in a gay marriage or relationship differently than they treat other couples, is this always bigotry that ought to be outlawed the way racism was? So I think there are actually differences in these different civil rights conflicts if you think about it. Consider that our civil rights laws, that in those civil rights laws, few civil rights and non-discrimination norms are absolute the way the prohibition of racism is. Religion's treated differently than race. Sex is treated differently. Disabilities are treated differently. There are exemptions or accommodations. There's different ways to deal with these things. Just to give a concrete example, you may know that federal civil rights law outlaws religious discrimination by employers when they hire and fire, etc. But the same fundamental law makes it legal for a religious organization to take account of religion when it hires and fires. So BYU, for example, could hire only LDS professors, and that's perfectly legal according to the same civil rights law that says a secular employer cannot discriminate based on religion in hiring. All right, so this is more complex than the question of race. Apparently, not all different treatment is always wrong. So a non-discrimination absolutism, if I can call it that, may steer us in the wrong direction. Our civil rights laws have many exceptions and accommodations to other rights and other realities. Second, conflicts between religious freedom and these other civil rights are often, I think, not disputes between religion and sexual equality, but rather disputes between different worldviews or moral systems. So we say something like this: here's a conflict where there's a religious belief on the one side, and on the other side, a person who identifies as gay or transgender who is simply seeking an education or a job or housing. So naturally, religion should give way to this real instance of injustice. Well, that's one way to interpret it. But actually, both parties in this kind of conflict often have convictions, legitimate convictions, about identity, sexuality, and justice. This isn't just a conflict between kind of an abstract religious doctrine, the way you read the Bible, something like that on the one side, and real human lives on the other. Rather, there are real human choices on both sides of these distinctions. One group of citizens is sure that gay conduct and relationships are morally no different than straight conduct and relationships. So, of course, there shouldn't be any difference in how people are treated in these different kinds of relationships. But, of course, there are many other people who are convinced that there are significant moral differences. That doesn't mean they hate people who are different, but they want to be faithful to what they think God has taught them about humanity. And they are sure that the godly design for marriage and sexuality is one way and not another way. So they want to be true to that by only conducting traditional marriages in their churches or by having a traditional moral conduct code for teachers, students, and staff in their educational institutions. And they want these distinctive standards not because they're against other people, but because they're for certain beliefs that are legitimate beliefs. And they think they ought to live consistently with those. Now, if the law says that the desire to have a school or church that operates consistently with traditional morality is just bigoted, a bigoted desire, and then makes those practices illegal, well, then that's the government taking sides on one or the other point of view, right? And the government has done that between these two moral positions, even though it's not wrong or illegal to be sure that God prefers traditional marriages and a biblical standard of sexuality. Of course, that doesn't mean you can oppress other people, but having that view and wanting to live consistently isn't wrong. So is there a way to protect everybody on both sides? That's the question. So in the guise of stamping out discrimination, a policy that just says it's illegal to treat everybody differently, no matter what the situation, actually suppresses religious freedom, even though the freedom to exercise your faith is a constitutional value. I don't think that's a good way to deal with these conflicts. Third, the religious freedom or religious exercise that needs to be protected is not only individual, but institutional. We've heard that a number of times today. So I want to stress that for a few moments. Individual religious freedom is essential, having to do with you and wherever you are, but it doesn't go far enough. I think the law also must strongly protect the ability of organizations to follow the practices of a religion or a secular philosophy if we are going to fulfill the American ideal of letting people live consistently with their deep convictions. Well, why should organizations be allowed to be distinctive? Organizations, so think of companies, universities, health clinics, drug treatment programs, and so on, are ways that people serve others, and distinctive organizations are ways to put distinctive views into practice, distinctive way of serving people, a distinctive way of relating to your employees. So that's why the curriculum and community life of BYU Law School is different from Yale Law School. There's a different vision of what living together is, what the law ought to be, the way things ought to be operated. Just to give another example, people in the charismatic Christian tradition expect the power of God to be operative in people's lives in a special way. So when these kinds of Christians created Teen Challenge, you know, that addiction research, addiction treatment organization, they created programs that utilize the power of the Holy Spirit to help people turn away from drugs and alcohol. So they use the power of the Spirit and not only counseling and medical interventions. That's the way they do things. Teen Challenge puts into practice a particular conviction about how addicts can be effectively helped. Now, if it becomes illegal because of new accreditation or civil rights standards for BYU Law School to keep its curriculum, its honor code, its employment requirements, community life standards, and so on, then the LDS vision of a fruitful life and a God-honoring educational program would be hemmed in and could not give much of a contribution to our society. It'd be illegal to run an institution that way. Same thing with Teen Challenge. Their vision of service, that exercise of religion, would be undermined or eliminated if people said, you can't put religion in a service that you offer to people. Well, let me say a little bit more about why institutional or organizational religious freedom is important. Think of a job seeker who is sure, because of her religious convictions, that it's best when possible, it's not against anybody else, but it's best when possible for a child who needs a new family to be placed with a mom and a dad who are in a flourishing marriage. She would like a career helping children who need new homes. But say the state government has said it will only license adoption agencies that agree not to discriminate based on sexual orientation and marital status in adoptions. Then this person with her legitimate convictions about children and families will find no compatible employer because nobody like that can exist. Or think of the patient with a very serious illness, a patient who believes that God makes suffering meaningful, who wishes a faith-filled atmosphere in his final days, and who is sure that doctors and nurses should not act to end a life that is not yet ready naturally to end. This person seeks a medical facility that values life and spirituality. But what if only secular hospitals or profit-driven hospitals that don't care about these things exist? Where will this patient be adequately served? You know, when we say our society is diverse in beliefs, that means not just that some people go to church and other people don't. It means that different people seek to live their lives by different standards. So if our laws don't allow organizations, for-profits, nonprofits, to embody different convictions, we're not really honoring the desire of these folks to live faithfully with their convictions. On the other hand, if we do allow for distinctive organizations, with distinctive employment practices, work cultures, distinctive ways of service, then our diverse citizens can find places in which to serve and from which to receive services that fit their religious convictions or their moral values. Well, I'm sure that there are, for example, restaurants where the staff must keep kosher. How else would you have a kosher restaurant? And is it bad to have one? I don't think so. And I also know that PETA, the animal rights organization, requires anyone who wants to be their media spokesperson or a fundraiser to have a consistent vegan lifestyle, which means I wouldn't be welcome there. Is that wrong or bad? I don't think so. It allows them to run a consistent organization. I think we need to let those kinds of things happen. Allowing institutions to be diverse in this way is the way to enable people with diverse convictions and identities to be able to live consistently with their deep desires and faiths. If civil society and the marketplace are diverse, then citizens with different convictions and moral systems will all find places to serve and be served. And then we can live together even though we have a lot of different values. But that's my fourth point. A public policy that protects this freedom for organizations to be distinctive, to embody these distinctive religious and other visions and values. This kind of pluralist government policy is a way to make it possible for us to live together despite our differences. You don't have to force yourself into somebody else's way of doing things. But of course, this isn't a magical solution. You saw that if I hadn't said it. It doesn't make all the conflicts go away. You know, if a religious nonprofit only hires people of a particular religion, then some job seekers who want to work there are going to be turned away. That's just life. And that job seeker may claim that this is wrongful discrimination. The cohabiting straight couple or the married gay couple who come to that adoption agency that only places children with married mother and father families, they may be inconvenienced and even offended that the agency doesn't help them. These are serious conflicts, so I want to say that. But I want you to notice three things as well. First of all, having to look for a different job is one of the most common experiences in life. There are a lot of reasons why we have to go one place or another to find some place that's compatible. Secondly, having to look for another place for service is not the same thing as being excluded from receiving a service, although we may be sorry that we didn't get the service at our place of first choice. In fact, there are many reasons why we all often have to look to one place and not another one for some kind of a service. When is that appropriate, when not? I think we need to think about that pretty hard. Thirdly, the burden of having to look further for service, for employment, is just the burden of pluralism and of allowing our fellow citizens to live according to their own values, not just in their homes, but in organizations that serve in our diverse society. And of course, when there is organizational diversity, that means that everyone at some time or another will find themselves not welcomed by some employer or some store or nonprofit. Certainly in our secularizing society, many people of faith find it difficult to find services and workplaces that they are truly happy with. But while in a diverse society, it's inevitable that everyone will encounter settings they regard as devaluing and discriminatory, I think careful government rulemaking can minimize those problems, help us to live together more harmoniously than if we just let everyone and every organization just do whatever. So I want to give two examples of pluralist public policy that help ease the problems when we are diverse and have diverse organizations. First of all, the faith-based initiative or government partnerships with religious organizations. Melissa Rogers worked in that under the Obama administration. I did under the Bush administration. You know, many religious organizations provide very good services, education, healthcare, adoption, and so on. So it's natural that government often contracts with or gives grants to these organizations to expand their services. That's the way the government gets its good work done often. Now, imagine if that Teen Challenge addiction prevention service got the government funding to provide those services to people who need help getting off drugs or alcohol. Well, now drug addicts seeking treatment would have to follow Teen Challenge's way, which is spirit-filled come to Jesus treatment program, which some people would not appreciate or find helpful. It's not right for people to be compelled to undergo religious discrimination to get a service they're entitled to. Right, so just giving Teen Challenge the money, say, you do all the drug treatment, wouldn't be right. Well, one way to solve that problem is to force Teen Challenge to become secular. Just do medical and psychological treatment, and then nobody will be offended when they come to get your services. But then, of course, nobody would have Teen Challenge's type of services either. And maybe it's the best way to help some people. So the faith-based initiative has a different solution than secularizing the providers. It actually has two solutions. The general solution is that religious organizations can compete for the government funding without suppressing their religious character or eliminating voluntary religious activities, but they can't turn away anyone because of religion, and they can't put religion into the government-funded service. They can offer it separately, but not in the government-funded service. And you can come, whatever your faith is, you won't be turned away, you'll get a service that doesn't impose upon your own views. So the organization remains religious, but for the person coming for help, they're not compelled to engage in religion that they object to or that's not their own. That's the general solution. The second solution is called indirect funding, or the voucher principle, or scholarship. You could call it a number of things. When the person seeking the service can choose between different government-funded providers, then a religious organization can offer services that actually do include religion, such as a Teen Challenge Addiction Recovery Program. And that's the Supreme Court said that's perfectly fine. In this indirect funding arrangement, it isn't the government that's choosing to fund religion. It's a person going for help, and they pick a place that offers this kind of treatment instead of another one. In this scheme, which I think is preferable, a person who seeks services that include a religious emphasis can find that kind of service, and the people who want only secular help can find secular help. I think that's the best way to go in our diverse society. So here's a pluralist policy that protects institutional diversity and also individual rights. So my second example of what I think is a good public policy is the Fairness for All idea. You all know something about that. Fairness for All was first put into practice here in Utah, combining new civil rights for LGBT people with enhanced protections for religious institutions and religious people. And I'm glad to be part of very extensive discussions in Washington, D.C. to achieve a similar Fairness for All federal agreement. Just as here, our idea is to create new protections for LGBT people at the federal level, while also creating strong protections for religious institutions and people that have a contrary view of human sexuality. Then Americans can live side by side, even though they differ about these important things. We are sure it's wrong for a gay couple not to be able to rent an apartment, or for somebody to be kicked out of a job simply because she got married to her same-sex partner. But it would also be wrong, we think, to require an Orthodox Jewish school or a Muslim charity to abandon its moral conduct code for employees, for volunteers, and for students. We should find a way to protect rights on all sides. Because we are so divided about marriage and families, for example, I think the only fair and sustainable policy in the area of adoption is to assure LGBT people of their right to adopt. That's what the law is. Just confirm that. But not require every adoption agency, whatever their convictions are, to assist with gay adoptions. Adoption decisions, as you know, are normative questions about children's best interests and what's the best match. And we differ greatly about these things. And on top of that, accepting an adopted child is a major undertaking for a family. And it's more likely that families will volunteer to do this when they are recruited by an agency that they trust and that holds some moral authority with them. So it's quite natural that the way things have happened, private adoption agencies at the moment are very diverse. Some reflect a religion, some are secular, some cater to traditional family values, others are explicitly progressive. I think they should all be able to operate within the law. The government can maintain a list of agencies for prospective adoptive families to consult. It could even require agencies to refer people to another agency or to the government list if their values and special competence doesn't match the person or couple who walks in the door. In this way, the diversity of adoption agencies can best serve the diversity of our society without anyone who is legally free to adopt being restricted from adopting. Well, I think that's what a pluralist policy should do in our country when we disagree about so much and yet should be able to live side by side. The government should protect a diversity of organizations, businesses, and nonprofits, even as it watches out for the rights of individuals. The rights of individuals should not be pursued at the expense of the rights of organizations, because individual rights, like the rights of employees, service seekers, organization creators, can only finally be and completely fulfilled when organizations are legally free to be distinctive. Thank you.
And it's wonderful that all of you are here centered and focused on such an important issue, the issue of religious freedom, which I believe is really the centerpiece, the center and most important freedom that exists in the United States. It really is the core of our commitment to pluralism. And it's not just a policy or a platform It's rather foundational. It's part of the Articles of Peace that allow very diverse people to live together. And so I'm very grateful for those who have worked so hard to put together this conference year after year and to make it really one of the nation's preeminent gatherings of scholars, lawyers, and citizens concerned about doing the hard work of citizenship to preserve religious freedom. And there is indeed lots of work to do. The cultural conflicts that threaten religious freedom continue to rage. Too many on both sides of the ongoing culture war take absolutist positions that serve only to antagonize and inflame the other side. And yet, in the midst of it all, I believe there is hope. Hope that reasonable compromises and solutions can be found to preserve religious freedom while accommodating often radically different moral visions and visions of marriage, family, gender, and sexuality. In my remarks today, I'm going to sketch out my own understanding of a model for reaching such compromises, which some, including Stanley, have referred to as fairness for all. And then I want to talk for a few minutes about the need for society and the law to reaffirm what might be called the right to gather, the right of believers to gather and establish communities of the faithful. I believe that without recognizing and protecting a strong right to gather for religious purposes, there is very little hope that any kind of compromise can be struck, because religious people and their institutions will face an existential threat. But once that right is strongly affirmed and protected, I believe there is reason for great hope that our current cultural conflicts can be resolved without destroying religious freedom. But first, we need to be clear about where we are culturally. Why? Because, like it or not, culture ultimately drives law and shapes how we understand our rights, and that includes constitutional law and religious rights. It also shapes what sort of compromises can be made as we seek for peaceful solutions to conflicts. We exist in a cultural context, and we can't escape that context, at least not very far. So where are we culturally? Very briefly, and engaging in lots of gross overgeneralizations, we live in an age of secular individualism, at least in the United States, and in an age of growing personal autonomy. Americans are now freer than ever before to choose the life they want without traditional constraints. The vast majority of Americans are wealthy by almost any historical standard. The problem that plagued all civilizations throughout all humanity was starvation. Now our primary problem is too much food. We can access more information than ever before and express ourselves in 1,000 different ways to potentially millions of people. Cultural and legal constraints that once hindered women have rapidly given way to innumerable individual, social, professional, and political opportunities. Many constraints that once limited or guided our actions have been loosened or abandoned. Legal and social constraints on sexual intimacy between consenting adults are essentially gone. Cohabitation out of wedlock childbearing and child rearing are no longer truly frowned upon. There is easy access to birth control, abortion, and divorce, even biological sex. Basically, the first thing we ask about when a child is born is being challenged as a fixed constraint. And as a culture, we celebrate the exercise of such freedoms as an ultimate good. The cultural message is to be your own person, to be true to yourself, follow your dreams, don't let anyone tell you what to do. And not only should you be true to who you are, but you should never, ever stand in the way of others being true to who they are. It naturally follows that one of the worst social crimes for individuals or institutions is to be judgmental or discriminatory. Toleration is owed to everyone, except for those whose beliefs, expressions, or practices are deemed intolerant. And for them, increasingly, there is little toleration and little mercy. Not surprisingly, in this cultural context, support for expansive LGBT rights is high and growing. How could it be otherwise? Especially among young people. The NewsHour program on PBS recently reported that, quote, support among young whites for employment equality for LGBT individuals rose from 84% to 92%. And then it went on to talk about how the trend for other ethnic groups is basically the same. In this context, it is no wonder that every metric indicates that America is becoming more secular and less connected to religious organizations like churches, with all their preaching about things like faith and repentance and obedience and sexual morality. Indeed, the decline of religiosity in the United States may be driving many of these trends that I've just mentioned. But, and this is a key point, despite growing secularism and despite a growing disaffiliation with institutional religion, traditional religion and traditional religious culture are by no stretch gone, and nor are they destined to disappear. Tens of millions of good Americans continue to be deeply religious and connected to a church, synagogue, mosque, or other house of worship. And traditional religious beliefs, including those about marriage, family, gender, and sexuality, are still fundamental to their identities and ways of life. Polling suggests that over 100 million Americans still believe that marriage, legally, should only be between a man and a woman. So contrary to the fond hopes of some, traditional religious beliefs regarding sexuality are not going away. They are nothing like the theologically bogus arguments that sought to justify slavery or racism. Rather, they are deeply woven into the fabric of all major monotheistic religions. The religious people and religious institutions that hold and live such beliefs will not simply fade away under social and legal pressure. These cultural realities and increasingly dominant secular culture that is colliding with a smaller and somewhat shrinking but still very durable religious culture create the possibility of perpetual cultural conflict. But the reality is that most Americans don't want perpetual conflict over these issues. They want practical solutions to the culture wars that preserve religious freedom while appropriately addressing claims for reproductive rights and for LGBT rights. Polls show that people still strongly support religious freedom. They may not know exactly what religious freedom entails, and all of their conceptions may not be legally or philosophically sound, but Americans don't see themselves as suppressors of religious freedom. That's not who they want to be. On another hand, they also don't want to see themselves or to be suppressors of LGBT rights. They are rather looking for sensible, reasonable solutions that lead to peace. They seem to be saying, in the words of that great philosopher Rodney King, "Can't we all just get along?" But that, of course, is easier said than done. One of the many challenges is that activists on both sides of the culture war have both deep ideological commitments and vested interests in perpetuating the conflict. Both sides are afraid of being marginalized and crushed by cultural forces they don't control. Both sides want to expand or at least preserve the cultural and legal territory they already occupy. And both sides, to be frank, have donor bases that see any slight in their positions as the end of the world. But this conflict also poses serious risks to both sides, whether they want to realize it or not. For religious traditionalists, the risks are fairly obvious, and they are that the secular left will succeed in using the power of government and society to marginalize and silence traditional religious voices and suppress, defund, or even destroy religious institutions critical to the survival of those voices. Those with religiously conservative beliefs about sexuality and gender risk becoming true outsiders in this great nation. And for the secular left, even though the secular left is growing more and more dominant, the risk is that they will win ugly. That is, that they will become what they once claimed to oppose: oppressors, censors, invaders of people's sacred spaces, the destroyers of true diversity, and the generators of new victims with another set of profound resentments. They risk, in other words, winning the cultural war, but losing the cultural peace. In the end, neither side can truly get what it wants without the other. And the irony, as Professor Douglas Laycock has noted, is that both sides want essentially the same thing: freedom to live in dignity and basic equality according to their deepest beliefs and needs. All of this is a prelude to say that there has to be a better way to figure this out rather than tearing our country apart and having perpetual cultural conflicts. Some have referred to this as fairness for all, There are lots of other labels, but what it really boils down to is reviving basic American pluralism, ensuring to the maximum extent possible that everyone has enough legal and social space to live out their deepest beliefs and identities. Based on my personal experiences with these issues, including with the 2015 Utah Compromise legislation, I believe there are four elements to a successful fairness for all approach to the conflict over religious and LGBT rights. And there are lots of other things. Stanley and I have been working on some federal legislative issues, but these are four keys that I think are really important. Some of these will be obvious. First, it begins with both sides sitting down and talking with each other. Imagine that. Understanding each other as real people with real lives and real concerns. It begins by building trust and friendships across the cultural and moral divide. It begins with a realization that we're talking with real people, even real people that have very different viewpoints, but people that we can respect and appreciate. Second, both sides must be willing to acknowledge and protect a zone of fundamental rights and freedoms for the other side. Neither side should face an existential threat to its core rights and interests, which means that each side should avoid creating conflicts that the other side must win to survive. Otherwise, there's no room for compromise. Anytime someone is placed in a position of facing an existential threat, that person will simply fight to the death, and there's no way to talk them out of it. Third, both sides should strive to be realistic and sensible about what is a core right and interest. Not everything we want or feel strongly about is truly core. There needs to be some realism and common sense. Each side has to set priorities and avoid considering every slight in a morally diverse society as a serious threat to religious freedoms, equality, or dignity. We can't raise every single thing to the level of a core right. And fourth, when conflicts arise outside core rights, and they absolutely will, both sides should seek for reasonable compromises that seek to accommodate everyone's interests as best possible, rather than ideological purity. Now, this is what I'm trying to capture here, where you have a center that is core, what each side sort of needs to survive. And then there are other things that are important, but which might result in overlap and conflicts. And it's in that area that we have to be willing to strike some reasonable compromises. This is a very pragmatic approach. It's what lawyers and business people do all the time when negotiating settlements or deals, when they know that they can't get everything they want, but they need to reach an agreement for the good of both sides. The goal is a win-win solution, not perfection. When both sides are operating within a fairness for all or pluralism framework, creative lawyering can usually bridge the gap. What creative lawyering can't bridge are rigid ideological positions that just simply clash. That was the approach we tried to take here in Utah with the 2015 Utah Compromise. That's been criticized on the left, it's been criticized on the right. But when it was all said and done, it worked pretty well, and most people walked away from it feeling like it was something that they could be united around. And it brought some peace and a measure of comfort, especially to the LGBT community, but also to religious people who were deeply concerned about what LGBT rights entailed. Now, I don't want to downplay the difficulty of reaching fairness for all compromises. It's actually exceptionally difficult, even when both sides truly want to get there. And again, Stanley and I have direct experience on this front. You can spend literally hundreds of hours trying to work through these issues. But where there's a commitment, you typically find a way to work things out, where there's a relationship, where there's a desire to end the conflict and figure out ways to live together. There are approaches that I believe can work. But the fairness for all or pluralism approach does face some serious obstacles from both the cultural right and the cultural left. And these are concerns that are basically sort of ideological concerns that we need to get over. On the cultural right, some minimize the obvious mistreatment of LGBT persons that they have faced throughout history. Others acknowledge past mistreatment, but claim that LGBT persons deserve no specific protection in the law because there's no specific problem in the present. It was all in the past, so let's not worry about it. On that ground, they oppose essentially all laws extending rights specifically to LGBT persons, denying not only legal protection, but, and this is often even more important, symbolic legitimacy to a group that has long been discriminated against and that still feels very vulnerable. Further, some religious conservatives see any compromise on LGBT rights as a betrayal of deeply held religious beliefs and, in any event, utter foolishness because the LGBT community supposedly will never honor a compromise. If you simply give them a little bit, they will come back and demand more and more and more, and therefore no stable compromise can ever be reached. These views on the right, which I reject, are a recipe for endless conflict and obviously are serious obstacles to any kind of fairness for all approach. But it's not only the right that has that imposes obstacles. On the other side, the cultural warriors of the secular left are pressing their advantage at nearly every turn. Once defenders of toleration for diverse views regarding sexuality, too often they are now the enforcers of a rigid new orthodoxy that tolerates only one viewpoint, and that any speech that is outside of that viewpoint is denounced instantly as homophobic or as bigotry. This, of course, is what terrifies those on the other side of the aisle who are concerned about religious freedom. I want to talk about three specific lines of thought on the cultural left that I see as serious obstacles to reasonable compromises. First, as mentioned earlier, many LGBT activists seem to believe that religious traditionalists will simply disappear if there's enough legal and social pressure applied, refusing to understand that tens of millions of Americans of faith are just not going to change their religious beliefs and abandon them about their religious beliefs regarding sexuality merely because of social pressure, and they're certainly not going to magically disappear. If only 20% of the population retains traditional religious beliefs regarding marriage, family, gender, and sexuality, we're still talking about 64 million people. Are we prepared to ostracize and legally suppress that many people? America just doesn't tend to do that sort of thing. Second, and even worse, is the repeated accusation that deeply held religious beliefs regarding marriage and sexuality are really nothing more than bigotry akin to racism. And this is unfortunate. Rarely do we hear LGBT activists publicly say, and there are some that do, but not enough, say what Justice Kennedy accurately acknowledged in the gay marriage decision, that informed people of goodwill can sincerely and validly hold different beliefs about marriage and sexuality. Instead, there is a pernicious equating of traditional moral beliefs with racial bigotry. In other words, with evil and with a dark ignorance. That view certainly makes it difficult to reach compromises, both because you assume that such beliefs will simply collapse of their own evil and stupidity, and thus shouldn't be legitimized through legal protections, and because you assume that you're negotiating, that the people you're negotiating with on some level are themselves bad or at least dangerously ignorant. It makes for a great deal of difficulty in negotiating if you're coming at this from a view that your opponents are just simply bigots. These two erroneous ideas are tied to a third one that makes compromise difficult. It's the notion that when people of faith gather under shared religious beliefs, commitments, and standards, that they are actually engaged in invidious discrimination. This view lies at the heart of attempts to cut back on the right of religious organizations and schools to hire people who truly believe in and live their religion. It lies behind the effort to shame, defund, and deny accreditation to religious schools that have traditional codes of conduct, and even to deny employment to the students of such schools based upon the religious beliefs of the schools that they attended. Not only does this view make it extremely hard to reach fairness for all compromises, it fundamentally threatens, I believe, the very heart of religious liberty. So let me explain that in conclusion. In Matthew, Christ teaches that where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Ezekiel tells the children of Israel that the Lord will gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered. And Mormon scripture speaks of gathering a worthy people to a new Zion, where the pure in heart can live in righteousness and peace, and where even God can ultimately dwell among them. There is, in other words, within Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and nearly all other religions, a fundamental need to gather with the faithful. It is not peripheral or incidental or merely some nice thing that religious people do. It is inherent and basic to most faith traditions. This compelling need to gather was a critical driving force behind the colonists who settled America, many of which were denied the right to do so in their native lands. The Puritans of Massachusetts, the Quakers of Pennsylvania, and the Catholics of Maryland all sought a place and space for their religious communities to gather and live in peace. To take just one example from this early era, while bound for America, Governor John Winthrop preached a famous sermon aboard the Arabella, in which he described the Puritans of Massachusetts as a gathering of fellow members of Christ. Justice Brennan captured the vital importance of religious communities in his concurrence in Amos, and here's what he said. For many individuals, religious activity derives meaning in large measure from participation in a larger religious community. Such a community represents an ongoing tradition of shared beliefs, an organic entity not reducible to a mere aggregation of individuals. This is what Stanley was talking about earlier. Determining that certain activities are in furtherance of an organization's religious mission and that only those committed to that mission should conduct them is thus a means by which a religious community defines itself. In short, it is impossible to speak of religious freedom in any coherent way without acknowledging that people of faith have a fundamental right to gather and govern their religious affairs. And this right extends beyond gathering to worship and participate in religious services on holy days. It must extend as well to a reasonable and robust degree to the right to form other organizations, such as religious schools and religious charities, where believers can live out their deepest faith commitments. Let us be clear. Without this right, there is no meaningful religious freedom. And inherent in this right to gather with the faithful is the right to determine who constitutes the faithful. This is fundamentally a theological matter that cannot be decided by reference to secular logic or law. It is not a matter for the courts. As Justice Brennan recognized, it is a matter of religious self-definition. It is not for the state to establish religious standards of religious purity or worthiness or faithfulness. As Christ might have put it, it is not for Caesar to decide who is truly gathered in my name. To denounce this fundamental element of religious identity and self-definition as merely discrimination is not only inaccurate, but ultimately dangerous. The insistence that anti-discrimination laws and norms must apply within vital religious precincts is a direct threat to religious freedom at its most basic level. For if the state can control who participates in a faith community, it can ultimately control the nature of that faith community, including what it believes. No one who believes in the separation of church and state at its most basic level should support that end. In sum, and in conclusion, while non-discrimination laws and norms are a vitally important part of the American commitment to legal and social equality, they have always had their limits. Religious organizations, religious schools, and religious charities are vital places of gathering for the faithful, and thus differ in basic ways from quasi-public commercial enterprises operating in the marketplace. Much as non-discrimination laws do not and should not seek to regulate personal and intimate relationships, they likewise should not improperly intrude upon a religious community's right to gather for religious ends. I believe that a strong and unequivocal affirmation by the secular left and by the LGBT community of this fundamental right to gather would go a long way toward calming fears and allowing fairness for all, pluralism-type compromises to move forward. Thank you.